And
so who were some of the local bands you had play at Times Square?
We had Joker's Wild, Zarathustra,
Triad,
Mystics, Danny's Reasons, one other group that I remember that did very, very well there too.
Oh, you mentioned the Stilroven?
Yes, yeah. Stilroven.
Stilroven?
Yep.
Okay.
And what we did for the first time in the history of the nightclubs is we had a beer and wine night on Monday. And that was all the beer and wine, belly high wine that you could drink on Monday for like $3 to get in.
Was that a popular?
Turned out popular. And I later carried it over to another famous nightclub.
What was the capacity of Times Square?
Easy 1,000.
Seating and stage and
right, and the seating was elevated too, so that made it nice to watch the act. Mm-hmm. And the stage was like 5 feet high, 6 feet.
Are kids still dancing at this point, or is it now concerts?
Yeah,
still dancing.
Still dancing.
Okay, so we're
the concerts. I believe were still going on strong too at Labor Temple and places like that.
Did Danny's Reasons play at the Labor Temple?
Once, with Jeff Beck, and that's when Rod Stewart was the lead singer.
So we're talking about Times Square in downtown Minneapolis. So we're talking about Times Square. And what national bands did you bring in there, or national acts?
The national acts that played there, sat in, whatever you want to call it, let's see, were Janis Joplin, John Denver, Sweetwater, Atlanta Rhythm Section, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Poco, John Prine, Edgar and Johnny Winters, O.C. Smith. For the comedians, it was the Smothers Brothers and like Professor Irwin Corey and Pat Paulson.
Okay.
Janis Joplin.
Did you get a chance to spend some time with Janis?
Absolutely.
Well, tell me.
The whole incident is sort of unique. We were the supporting act with Crow, with Janis at the Minneapolis Armory.
Okay.
And I said, Janis, we have a club. Do you want a party afterwards? And she said, absolutely. So I said, do you have a way over? She says, no. I said, okay, I'll bring my Rolls Royce in. So I brought my Rolls Royce in while the people were leaving. And the unique thing about the Rolls Royce, all of them at that time, the keys were very brittle. The key broke off in the ignition, and Janis and I are sitting in the car and looking at each other and going, what? How do we get out of here? I said, well, do you have a tweezer so I could pull the broken part out? She says, oh, I always carry it for some of the men I date. And I went, okay, very interesting. So we got the key out, and we found a spare that I happened to accidentally have, got it going, and drove to Times Square. At that time, I was using nothing but Minneapolis police officers because they were like an insurance policy.
SWAT squad.
Yeah, tax squad to be exact.
For what purpose?
They were as bouncers, and they would check the IDs. So if anybody got through, they could say they had one heck of a phony ID. And I used John Locke, Murphy, all of them. And what they did is they got a hold of Stenvig, Charles Stenvig, and I think he was mayor at that time. And they said, look, if we get all the liquor off, can we allow an act to go later? And he says, only if I can show up.
In other words, there was a time you had to shut down at.
Yes, 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So they got all the liquor off, and before I knew
but
it, there's
you
like...
you never saw a bar clear liquor off so fast
quick.
Because he said Janis Joplin would like to jam.
Lo and behold, 25 other officers showed up with their wives. So we got like 800 to 900 people in.
This was a late night show.
Yeah, because I think we got out of the armory after I got the car running. I would say around 12 o'clock, maybe 12:30 even. And so we got there, and I called John Locke. He took care of it, and that's one of his greatest highlights. He likes to remember how Janis was talking with them, and he says, well, you can have something backstage. And
this is the Minneapolis
police. Minneapolis police.
She comes by herself without her band.
No, the band showed up.
The whole band
they wanted to party.
Showed up with instruments.
Oh.
And she had them all play. And so they played until about 3:30, 4 in the morning.
This is Janis Joplin and...
her band.
Big Brother and the Holding Company.
No. They were long gone by that time. This is...
she had a horn section and everything else. Well, I can't remember what the name of the group was at that time.
Well, it was her group.
Right, it was. But I mean...
Okay, yeah. So she performs?
She performs.
How was she?
Extremely good and very, very talkative to the people. She went out in the audience and would talk and then go back up on stage. And it turned out to be a very big highlight, I think, in my life. Mm-hmm. And that, which later gave me the idea, well, why don't I bring more people in? Because I'm an easier venue to get to and to see the acts, and certain acts you can have liquor, than Labor Temple, which was the big place at the time.
When you say easier, do you mean being in downtown in a...
Right, and we had more parking around us than the Labor Temple had on that, and so on and so on. And then I did find, as time went on, there are many acts that I forgot to mention that were national that came there, that the promoters would sometimes rent the building for a Friday night, give me the liquor, they would take the door, and so on.
Did you have bands on the weekends at Times Square during the week? And
Friday, Saturday, and Monday.
Okay. And Monday was the beer and wine.
Beer and wine night with at least two bands.
Mm-hmm. What happens to Times Square?
We started turning that area around. It was Kitty Corner from the Normandy, and the other Kitty Corner, you could say, was Charlie's, Exceptional. Jack Dow got a hold of me and said, Danny, I have a chance, I can't remember if he said, to sell the whole building and the liquor license and so on to the Friars Club. Would you allow me out of my lease? And I said, yeah, but what am I going to get for it? Says, I have a Class A license. And I naturally questioned him. I said, would you get a Class A? Because remember, this was the history that all liquor licenses at that time had a value. You didn't buy them off the shelf. You had to get them someplace. Either a building tore down or you bought a club and then begged the council person to transfer it to another ward if you could.
In other words, they were not issuing new liquor licenses.
No. And in fact, what I thought was unique, it was a time when I applied for that license, it literally said, which was discriminating, are you related to Isidore Blumfeld, parentheses, Kid Gann?
Who are these people?
They control the liquor industry for both twins, you know, St. Paul and Minneapolis. Mm. And naturally, we filled it out and said no, and da-da-da-da. But anyways, the Class A license came from the Hotel Hastings, which was directly behind the Orpheum Theater. And they were famous for their marquee club that they had that a lot of businessmen belonged to. I only was in there to meet Jack during the day, so I never knew what was unique about it. So, but it's in the area now where the new Greyhound bus depot exists behind the Orpheum. So from that, Jack Dow had contacted Ted Mann.
And Ted said, Mann is the movie theater guy?
Ted Mann, the movie theater guy, and his brother Marvin. At that time, the Greyhound Bus Depot had been sitting for a few years empty. I had a very interesting lady that helped my career in the society called Mrs. Heffelfinger, which was P.V. Mills, P.V. Plaza, very wealthy girl and lady, and she's the one that started us in the society.
And how did you meet her?
Through a society event.
Oh, okay.
She said, I like your band. Do you like to be like Peter Duchin? Well, I didn't know who that was. He was the son of Eddie Duchin.
Who was?
Society in New York. Tyrone Powers played the Eddie Duchin story, so on. And I did some, yeah, I said, yeah, because I was only interested in two things, making some money and how can I better myself. And I knew if I'm in the circle of the Wayzata people at that time in the 60s, I can better myself, because I was not completely counting on the musical career making me the money I wanted to make in life.
You had seen bands who were popular for a year or two,
right,
and then disappear?
Disappear, and didn't make in that era much money. Mm-hmm. Even if you listen to the interviews of the Beatles, the first 3 years of their Beatle era, they were not millionaires, they said. Mm-hmm. And that was Paul and I think George were saying that we were not millionaires. We look like we were, but Brian Epstein took a lot of the money. Yeah. So Mrs. Heffelfinger said, I want to be part of this. And she was like late 70s then.
And part I said, of what?
Of the new idea of the Depot. So I'm moving from Times Square to the Depot within a few months.
And the Depot is?
The Greyhound Bus Depot, which is now First Avenue.
It's sitting there vacant.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And she said, she talked to Ted Mann, I'll be the co-signer.
You had an idea to transform the bus station?
Yes. My idea originally started that that was going to be the Fillmore Midwest. And I had talked to Bill Graham, and he says, here's what. I can't make it the Fillmore Midwest because you don't want to deal with my family if something happens to me and I'm not in the greatest health. But I will give you the acts that are going from the West Coast Fillmore to the East Coast Fillmore.
So they could stop on the way.
Yeah, because those acts basically were acts he had a piece of the action. I said, you got a deal. Again, then Mrs. Heffelfinger and I sat down. We said, how can we make this unique besides having the acts? And she says, do you like beer? And I said, not really. Well, Bill Coors is my best friend. And we supply the grain and da-da-da-da. So she called Bill, and we got on the phone. He says, Peavy, now do you understand? You're going to have refrigeration for this. She says, we have refrigeration. And so we were going to open it with Coors, that this is the only place in the upper Midwest you can drink Coors. Because you couldn't.
So
exclusively.
Exclusive.
Yeah, because he had no intention, remember, in the 60s of expanding. It was down to like Kansas City, St. Louis, Dallas, Houston, naturally Colorado and that. But otherwise, you couldn't buy Coors here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So she was putting it together. Then she got ill. She said, look, I'll still follow through with the project, but if you find somebody else. I had already worked out the deal with Ted Mann and Marvin.
To purchase the building?
No, to lease it to start out with. We had the building, but they had the property.
Who were the owners?
Ted and Marvin Mann.
Okay, they own
the movie theater people.
Okay.
Yep.
So you had a plan to lease the building from them,
yes,
and turn it into a nightclub.
Yes, with concerts.
Specifically with the idea of having national bands come in.
Absolutely.
With financing through Heffelfinger?
Yes, at that time. Because I knew I needed deep pockets, because that was the era, even though you got the bands reasonable, you had to lock them up for 6 months at a time. And in order to lock them up, you had to put 50% down. So there were periods later, once we got it open, that we had over $1 million, which was a lot in 1970 to have out, just sitting there, not making interest or whatever.
So who paid for the, I assume the whole interior was gutted, right?
Yes.
And needed to be rebuilt.
Well, that was my new partner that I got.
Who was?
Alan Fingerhut. Originally, Alan was like a wealthy groupie. But then he got into it seeing the crowds where he wanted to show his father. It was all an ego thing on his father that, not his father's part, but wanted to show that he was just as smart as Manny Fingerhut. And I had to tell him a million times, Alan, people like your dad are very rare. You don't have to show them anything. You just take your money and improve it. So one thing led to another. He became my partner. We originally were going to open up with Santana from Woodstock. And we got a call, and I want to say, but I can't remember, but I think it was from David Zimmerman, because David had managed us and that. And he says, you know, and like I said, I can't be sure because it's been so long ago, I don't even think about it. But I thought he said, there's an act out there that Bobby thinks maybe might be better for you.
Bobby was who?
Bob Dylan. That was David's brother.
Brother.
And I said, who? And he said, Joe Cocker. And they're going to call themselves Mad Dogs and Englishmen. I said, I just played with them a few months ago with a Grease band, and they're not going to draw like Santana. And he said, no, 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 this is going to be like 30-some people on stage and da-da-da-da-da. And I went, well, let me look into it. Well, they were only going to play like four or five times together, and that was it. It was Bonnie and Delaney, Leon Russell, Nicky Hopkins, Eric Clapton was sitting in. It just was a lot of superstars, so I thought, well, let's try it. So Alan and I agreed on that, and we ended up opening the Depot with that act.
What year was that?
1970, April.
Okay. So they show up to play. What happens?
The thing was packed. At least 2,000 people.
Well, you sold out. By 8 o'clock, you sold out every ounce of liquor in the place. And because you knew Phillips, you called him, and he brought truckloads of liquor back in.
Yep. And Mickey was overlooking the bar. I have to say, if it wasn't for the help of Abby Rosenthal, mm-hmm. Clarence Kramer, they lived and breathed that club. So during the construction, it was not me, and it absolutely was not an Alan Fingerhut. Mm-hmm. These guys, even my brother was down there constantly helping whatever he could do, because he was a very, very good bartender, Mickey. We get there. Joe Cocker sees, or his manager, but naturally Joe was pushing it, sees the crowd. Several thousand people outside.
Outside, stretching probably two blocks down the way, past the Mann theaters and everything, waiting or trying to figure out one way or another to get in.
On that.
What was the capacity?
I'm guessing 1,000.
I assume it went over.
Oh, yeah. And we had two shows a day. And remember, we had them, I can't remember, it was either 2 or 3 days. We either had them Friday, Saturday, or Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay.
And we got them really cheap. It was like, don't hold me to the exact amount, but I thought it was like $6,500 to $7,000 for the show. Well, Joe Cocker saw all this, and I say Joe, but it was his manager with the thing, saw the crowd and tried a fast one on Alan.
Really?
Said, we aren't going on stage tomorrow or the next day unless we get more money.
They were booked for more than one night?
Yeah, three nights.
Mm-hmm. Three nights in a row?
Yeah. Yeah.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Manny Fingerhut steps in, who I have all the respect in the world for, and his son-in-law is Teddy Dykel. And Teddy was like our CFO for us, watching the money and whatever. And they say, you're not paying them. We deal with the Teamsters every day, and the Teamsters have assured me, and this is Manny, have assured me that those trucks aren't leaving. And so the equipment is here, so if they want to purchase other equipment and have the word out why they don't have the equipment, that they pulled a heist on somebody. And Manny made it very clear to both Alan and I, they do not get any more money. Maybe a bonus if we make a lot of money, but the contract is the contract.
They had already signed a contract for the three nights.
And they had their money, half of their money, already up front.
Okay.
So they thought they could pull a fast one. Alan turns around, behind his father's back, pays him. His father almost smacked him in the thing. And he says, well, I want a good reputation out there. He says, business is business. Let them know that you're a hard businessman. You're fair, but you're a hard businessman. He says, well, I actually thought he raised his hand to him, but I didn't see that, because he said, can we talk, Danny? And you could hear him through the door, you know. What kind of idiot are you? The bottom line is Manny had it set that Joe Cocker's stuff would not leave this city until they lived up to their contract or paid us for our losses if they decided to take their plane out. But from that point on, people that don't get recognition for that place, one is myself. Alan has convenient memory loss at times, but I want to say if this is ever on, you know, the internet and whatever, Abby Rosenthal lived and breathed that. And as I showed you, February 28th, 1970, big article in the Star and Tribune, and Abby is in there. In the paper article.
And Abby is...
He was our general manager. Clarence Kramer, which was assistant manager, lived and breathed that club. Mm-hmm. Alan never gives him credit. His wife, Sharon Fingerhut, was the pillar of that whole thing because he was off into tangents doing this and that. Was unacceptable. But
Joe Cocker sells out nights in a row.
Yep. And sets the stage for further acts, mm-hmm. because the word was, you can get your money here and whatever. Mm-hmm. So we had the last show of Rod Stewart and the Small Faces. Mm-hmm. We had the last show of Jethro Tull. We had Frank Zappa with Iggy and, Flo and Eddie.
Right. Yeah. Frosty Turtles.
Yep.
Ike and Tina Turner,
yeah,
Richie Havens, and Richie Havens came on for his last show at 10 o'clock. He didn't get off till 2 o'clock. He was supposed to only play an hour, and he was apologizing to the audience. He says, I can't play anymore. I busted every string on my guitar, every string on my lead guitar. I have no more strings to play. And that was 4 hours after he was supposed to get off stage. Mm-hmm.
James Gang, by the time they hit us,
Allman Brothers.
Yep.
The winners.
Yep. There were so many.
Mitch Ryder, Detroit Wheels.
Mason Prophet. And then Dave Mason, mm-hmm. also. There were so many. Then we had it where we tried to do it where the local bands would always be on one of the national shows.
As an opening act.
As an opening act. Mm-hmm. So they could get spotlighted there. We brought over from Times Square Beer and Wine Night. We had blizzards, and it was waiting lines to get in. I mean, the college students and the professors were there because it was $4 and all the beer and wine. They didn't realize that there may have only been in that whole place two bartenders.
Yep.
That. And the way you see First Avenue now, we had more bars at mm-hmm. the Depot.
Really?
Yeah, when you're looking at the stage, and you go down and you see that bar there mm-hmm. underneath, not at the stage, but underneath the balcony, there's a bar to the left that was probably about
as big 20 as feet. The main bar, and there's a bar to the right as big as the main bar. There's two bars upstairs.
Well, we didn't have those in the beginning because the object that I stole from the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard was all ages could be upstairs.
Oh, okay.
And they'd do the wristband.
So no alcohol.
No alcohol was up there in the beginning. And so that's how we could sell out Sunday shows. We'd have the all ages, I think the first show. And the second show, if you're under 21, you could go upstairs and watch the act. And downstairs was the alcohol. So you couldn't be there with a wristband. Hmm. What I did do is I took a lot of people from the industry that I knew, like Zoner. Do you know Zoner? I don't know. Yeah, you know.
The band boy for the litter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, I love Zoner. Great guy. He did the sound, he and the people there. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, it was a lot of affiliation with Minneapolis acts. Mm-hmm. And
so your role during this time period in relation to the Depot was primarily what? Are you?
I would put my input on the acts.
Okay.
Because I was still performing, right. Ted Deichel and them actually ran the business end of it. Even though I owned 50% of the company, they would handle the business end. And in my opinion, Ted Deichel was very good. Naturally, he favored the Fingerhuts because he was married to Manny's daughter. Mm-hmm. So we could do it. And then later they brought in a manager called Joe Sandino. And he was a nice guy, but he was there strictly for the Fingerhuts to try to get their money back.
And how long is your involvement with the Depot?
Well, what's sort of funny, since you guys called us, I started looking up at articles. They, in my opinion, and so we'll use it this way, rumors have it that they have never bought me out. And what an angleworm, because Tim Kerr, who was like my guru, goes, you know, they never bought you out as far as I know, because you would have told me. And I said, you're right. I don't remember ever. So when all they were changing from Uncle Sam, well, Uncle Sam's, like Mickey said on the way over, they knew I was an owner that owned 50% and that that was my liquor license. Because Uncle Sam's was a company out of
New York.
Well, I thought they were out of Cleveland, too. Cincinnati,
well, they owned
that
a
needed
whole
to
bunch
use
of clubs on
yeah.
the East Coast.
They were the largest disco chain. They had them in Buffalo, Syracuse, Miami, Detroit, Omaha, Des Moines, Dallas, Houston.
So you had a company that didn't own the building, but
right.
ran the place.
Ran the place, and we had an unlimited amount of rent there because Ted Mann didn't really
okay.
care about doing anything there.
And that company was owned by you
and
Alan Fingerhut.
And it's called the Committee, Inc.
The Committee, Inc. Okay. You never bought out?
No, to the best of my... That's my question. What happened is, when you deal with Alan, it's like everything is Alan's way, and it's my money. He forgets that when you put money in for stock, it becomes the company's stock or money, mm-hmm. if that makes sense to you. In other words,
yeah.
if you're buying your stock with money and I'm buying it with a $300,000 to $400,000 liquor license, my stock, that money is supposed to be run by the company. And that's what Teddy Deichel tried to emphasize with him. Mm-hmm. And what happened, I just let him go off on his own, and meaning I was tired of arguing with him that watch your spending. A prime example, I love to use this example. He was so infatuated with Tiny Tim. Yeah.
And Ramsey Lewis.
Yeah. And I said to him, as far as Tiny Tim, I said, I don't think we should do that act. I don't think it'll draw, because the feel of this club is not that. So he goes ahead, and without anybody knowing, I mean, Ted got mad at him about this. So he hires Tiny Tim mm-hmm. at $20 a ticket. Well, Friday and Saturday, you could see Tiny Tim free at the Minneapolis Auto Show. I said, who's going to pay if you can go see him free? So that's what I was dealing with at that time. Because, like I said, he was a very rich groupie that had never got recognition. All along, it was always his father and then Ted Deichel, who did a lot with Irwin Jacobs and that. So Alan wanted his spot. Now, his brother, on the other hand, Ronnie, who put in by loaning to Alan a lot of money, just sat back, followed whatever his father invested in, like combs and things like that. He made money. He said, I'm not reinventing the wheel. So anyways, that was basically the history of from the depot, Uncle Sam's, to First Avenue.
So does the Committee, Inc. exist to this day?
They have to, because nobody has closed it. And why I stayed out of it, if you noticed in the paper, there was a huge fight of who owned it between Byron Frank. And Ronnie came to ask me if I'd be a witness. And I said, how did Byron Frank end up with 80% of the company when I still own some and Alan owns it? And he says, you don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear it. So that war didn't involve me at all. I just sat back, watched what they did and whatever. And then the minute that Byron Frank and whoever this other guy is basically started running First Avenue, they got rid of Steve McCullen, who I think, during my period of involvement, which was the depot, Uncle Sam's, Steve was a bartender during Uncle Sam's, but he was one of those young kids that knew music inside and out. I mean, I was there and I'd have to listen to him, and he was telling me things that, oh yeah, I sort of remember that. You know what I mean? He knew it. So he was a positive force for First Avenue then.
When was the change from the depot to Uncle Sam?